Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's start with a statement that I hope we all agree on. In Canada, if you haven't been charged with or convicted of a crime, you shouldn't be held in prison. Not for days or for months or for years. This is something we shouldn't have to debate, except in courtrooms across the country, it's being debated fiercely by immigration lawyers arguing before judges that their clients who were held without charge because they may have been a flight risk were put not in an immigration detention center, but in a maximum security prison, and then left there.
We're appealing that Ibrahim should be set free, and the government is appealing that he should be put back in a maximum security jail. He's been kept for 5 years on his presumption made by a single Canada Border Services Agency officer that his name is other than what he has said. Release him.
And those judges have sometimes been just as angry as the lawyers in front of them that this has happened. They've ordered some detainees freed, but there are always more. There are dozens of nonviolent refugees and asylum seekers right now in maximum security penitentiaries because somebody decided to put them there. Somebody's not an exaggeration. There's no oversight, no jury, no judge. Just the Canadian Border Services Agency making a call. Detention center or jail. And in jail, you're an inmate. That's it. So how does this happen? And under whose watch? And why isn't it more widely known? I would say it's a miracle that nobody's died as a result of this process, but someone has.
From Immigration Canada, just your wife had died. It was so cold. They, I believe, let her just suffer to death.
So welcome to the place in Canada's immigration policy where nobody's watching, except today's guest. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Brendan Kennedy is an investigative reporter at the Toronto Star. This has been his beat for a while now. Why don't we start with the person that kind of leads this whole thing off? Tell me about Ibrahim Touré, and who is he and what happened to him?
So Ibrahim Touré is a failed refugee claimant. He applied for refugee status way back in 2011, was rejected. And then at that point, he missed a meeting with immigration authorities with the Canada Border Services Agency. And there's some contentiousness about why he missed the meeting. But in any event, he then was arrested by CBSA. And because they believed that he at that point, after he'd failed his refugee claim was rejected, he was under a lawful deportation order.
Okay.
And once he missed the meeting, then they believed he was a flight risk or unlikely to appear for his deportation when it was arranged. So just to give a quick background, in Canada, non-citizens can be detained by the CBSA on three grounds. If they're a danger to the public, if they're unlikely to appear for their deportation or other immigration matter, or if their identity is in doubt.
Okay.
So in Ibrahim's case, he was considered a flight risk and he was detained and he spent then the next 5.5 years in indefinite immigration detention because the CBSA was unable to deport him. So he has a complicated background. He believes he was born in either the Gambia or Guinea. His father is from the Gambia, his mother's from Guinea. Both his parents are dead. He doesn't have any legal identity documents to either country. He came to Canada on a fake passport, which he then declared when he applied for refugee status and said, I used a fake passport to get here. Now that I'm here, I'd like to apply for a refugee claim. So he said he was cooperating. He was willing to be deported. But the countries that where he believes he has a rightful claim to citizenship refused to take him back, essentially. And Canada tried for many years to deport him, and they were unable to. They still believe that he could potentially be deported. But after 5.5 years, they gave up, essentially.
So he's in citizenship limbo.
Yeah, and he'll be, you know, he was released in September on a number of conditions. He has to report to the CBSA twice a month. He has to live with a surety. It's similar to bail-like conditions. And, you know, if he stays out of trouble, it's theoretically possible that over a number of years of adhering to the conditions that the CBSA gives him, that he could potentially have some kind of path to some kind of residency. I mean, citizenship is probably, if at all possible, a far way off. Mm-hmm. But he will be able to have some kind of regular status at some point. The last time I talked to him, he was working on getting a work permit, and he was planning to go back to the job that he had while he was applying for refugee status.
Where was he for those 5.5 years?
Yeah, so this is one of the most contentious parts of Canada's immigration detention system. Many detainees are sent to maximum security provincial jails, despite the fact that they are not charged or convicted of a crime. And when they are sent to jails, they are treated the same as any other sentenced criminal or those awaiting trial.
Who makes that call?
So this is where it gets a little bit complicated. So the decision to detain someone is initially made by the CBSA, and then they have to sort of bring the case to the Immigration and Refugee Board. And there is a detention review hearing after 48 hours of detention, and then 7 days, and then every 30 days thereafter. So during the 5.5 years that Ibrahim was being detained, he appeared before the Immigration and Refugee Board every 30 days. And that's when the government-appointed adjudicator, they call them board members, decided whether or not the detention would continue.
And it did each time for 5.5.
Yes. And there are lots of problems with the Immigration and Refugee Board in terms of their detention review hearings. Many of those were highlighted last year in a really scathing audit of their detention reviews, which criticized how they're run. But even, you know, with all those problems aside, one of the things that's not discussed in those detention review hearings is the place of detention, the location of detention. And basically in Canada, if you are an immigration detainee, you can be put in one of two places, provincial jails or immigration holding centers. And immigration holding centers are akin to medium security correctional facilities.
So what does that entail?
It's still essentially a jail, but it's far less restrictive. You're not locked in your cell. You have much more freedom of movement within the facility. You can't leave, obviously. Mm-hmm. You're still locked up. But you have much easier access to phones. You have much easier access to visitors. Your quality of life is you know, just less restricted and much better than it would be in a maximum security provincial jail. When you're in a provincial jail, you are locked up in a cell for a large part of the day. You wear an orange jumpsuit. You are often strip searched. You know, in many provincial jails, lockdowns are just a fact of life. And in those situations, you're essentially confined to your cell for, in some cases, days, weeks. And in those instances, you're not allowed to go outside. You can't use the shower. You are, you know, given your meals in your cell.
And with the exception of other detainees who might find themselves in this situation, you are inside with people who have at the very least been charged with crime, if not convicted.
Yeah, these are the most restrictive conditions that we have in our correctional system. I should point out that in Ontario jail, 70% of the people who are in provincial jails are legally innocent. They're awaiting trial, and that's a whole other issue. But these are the most restrictive conditions, and this is where many immigration detainees spend their detention, and particularly many of the long-term detainees, which Ibrahim obviously was. He spent 4.5 of his 5.5 years in immigration detention in a maximum security provincial jail, most of that time in Lindsay at the Central East Correctional Center. And then about a year before he was eventually released from detention, his lawyers essentially took the government to court, arguing that his detention violated the charter. And in that case, the judge said the government still had a right to detain him because at that time, the judge was convinced that there was still a prospect of deportation, but he said holding him in a maximum security jail amounted to cruel and unusual treatment and violated Ibrahim's charter rights. And so he was transferred to an immigration holding center, and then that's where he spent his last year in detention before he was released.
Tell me about the audit. Where did that come from? Who did it, and what did it find?
Yeah, so the Immigration and Refugee Board, it was an internal audit. Well, they got someone externally to do it, but they called it internally.
Why did they do it?
So there were a number of court cases, specifically Kashif Ali, the one who was the detainee. He was in immigration detention for more than 7 years. And also a man named Ricardo Scotland, who a judge essentially said that he was in jail for no real reason at all. He was someone who his refugee claim hadn't even been decided yet. He also had no criminal convictions. He had been charged, but the charges were dropped. and yet he was held in a maximum security jail. It was one of the most stunning court cases that I'd seen in the sense of how damning the judge's ruling was of Canada's immigration detention system. He said that, you know, the CBSA and the government can't explain, I'm paraphrasing, but yeah. Can't explain why Mr. Scotland is in jail. I can do it for them. He's in jail for no real reason at all. He immediately ordered Mr. Scotland's release from the courthouse, like actually from the prisoner's box. And I just remember Mr. Scotland kind of just being stunned himself. The government was actually scrambling to impose some kind of conditions on his release, kind of like bail. And the judge interrupted them and said, no, there won't be any conditions. There's no reason for him to be detained in the first place. And he was literally released from the prisoner's box into the body of the court. So that was one case. And I think that caused the publicity around that case and just the extent to which these judges were so strongly condemning the systemic aspects of...
Well, when the kind of faux court atmosphere that you describe runs up into a real judge in a real courtroom, you can see the discrepancy.
That's exactly it. And I think that these judges were shocked at some of the outcomes that the tribunal was coming up with. So they called this audit, and the report came out last year. It itself, the IRB said they would undergo a number of changes and they would do increased training for their members. They also said some cases, some really long-term cases, they would review all of them. I think that they identified anything that was longer than 6 months, that they would review those cases and see if they needed more scrutiny. They also started sending cases that had gone on for years that were in Ontario, for instance, to members in other parts of the country to see if having kind of fresh eyes would create a different outcome in the case. But, you know, when the audit came out, there was a group of 50 immigration lawyers who called on the entire board, the members, these adjudicators of the tribunal to resign en masse because the audit was so scathing of their work. So that didn't happen. But, yeah. You know, 50 immigration lawyers, you know, they may be biased because they're coming to the tribunal and have a lot of cases before them. But that's not a small thing for 50 lawyers to sign their names to something, to call for an entire board, these adjudicators, to resign en masse.
Do we have any idea how many nonviolent immigration detainees end up in maximum security facilities?
Yeah, so this has been going on for a long time. My recent story looked at, I've been looking at immigration detention and reporting on it for about the last 2 years. And anecdotally, I'd always come across these cases where guys like Ibrahim, who didn't seem to be, have any kind of violent past or, some immigration detainees have committed really serious crimes. Yeah. And they should be kept in really restrictive conditions prior to the deportation. But I just kept on coming across these cases where somebody may have had a very minor criminal record, no violence, and they'd served that time. And maybe there was a...
Can you give me an example of like what one of those offenses would look like or those people would be like?
Yeah. So another case that I've written a lot about is Teresa Grattan, a woman who actually tragically died while she was in immigration detention in a maximum security jail in Milton. And, you know, she was someone who was addicted to prescription painkillers. She was dependent on opioids. And a lot of her criminal history was kind of connected to that. She had petty theft. Her last criminal offense before she died was shoplifting at Walmart, for instance, just to give you an example of the kinds of things that she was arrested for and convicted of. And, you know, she was someone, so she had a very short criminal sentence. Then she was transferred to immigration detention because she wasn't yet under a lawful deportation order, but the CBSA was trying to deport her based on a series of criminal convictions. She was a longtime permanent resident of Canada, but she was from the U.S. and she didn't have citizenship. So they were considering deporting her. They wanted to deport her. And in this time, they believed that she wouldn't show up for her immigration hearings. She wouldn't show up for her deportation if they did arrange it. So they transferred her after her 23-day criminal sentence. They transferred her to a maximum security jail in Milton, the Vanier Center for Women. And this is someone who has no history of any violence. Mm. All her entire criminal convictions are very, very petty.
Low-level scams, the kind of things an addict would do for their fix.
And the CBSA's own guidelines say that detainees who have a minor criminal record or a criminal record with no violent offenses should be placed in an immigration holding center, a far less restrictive place, if they're going to be detained. She didn't spend very long in immigration detention, only about a month, but that's where she died. And I find there's aspects of her case that I just find just completely shocking and frustrating in terms of there were so many steps along the way where somebody should have stepped in and said that this decision that we're making is not right. And I think that she was failed on so many levels by multiple systems, by multiple governments. Her case, just the fact that she died in a maximum security jail while she was, you know, in indefinite immigration detention, I think speaking with her family, her children, her husband, you know, that's something that has stuck with me a lot. And I still find her case to be particularly shocking.
The rulings come from the CBSA and nobody's judging them on what they do. And until it gets to the kind of numbers that you've reported on, there doesn't seem to be any institutional momentum to actually do something on this.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people would be shocked if they saw the Immigration and Refugee Board detention review hearings and how, you know, a lot of this is covered in the audit that...
Give me an example of some of the things that would shock them.
You know, in the criminal court system, when the stakes are that somebody's liberty is in jeopardy, so that, you know, when someone's going to be locked up by the state, it's the greatest power that the state has,
yeah,
to lock someone up. So in the criminal court setting, there are a number of safeguards because the sanction is so high, because it's such a great power that the state has. So someone has a lawyer is guaranteed. There are a number of procedures in terms of like beyond a reasonable doubt.
Innocent until proven guilty.
There's all these safeguards. In the detention review hearings are more akin to almost traffic court. The system is designed to move through these cases quickly. And for a lot of cases, I should make clear here that most people spend only a few days in immigration detention. The average length of detention is 2 or 3 weeks. And most people are processed quickly. So for those kinds of people, the system works well. The problem is some cases drag on for months or years. And that when the sanction is an indefinite detention in a maximum security jail, you know, I would argue that there should be a higher threshold for these cases. So at the Immigration and Refugee Board, at these detention review hearings, you have someone who is kind of like a judge, but they're not a judge. They're essentially a government bureaucrat. And you have someone representing the CBSA who may have a legal background, but it's not required that they have legal training. The detainees are often unrepresented. So sometimes they're appearing via video from Lindsay. They're in orange jumpsuit. They have a translator, so they're following along with what's happening, but there isn't anyone with any legal training who's able to advocate for them. In many cases, sometimes, you know, lawyers do represent detainees. You know, in Ibrahim's case, when his case dragged on for so long, some lawyers stepped up to defend him. But, you know, in a lot of these cases, it just feels like the entire situation should be treated a little more seriously given the fact that we're talking about another 30 days in a maximum security jail, or in some cases, you know, when it's dragged on for 4 or 5, you know, 6, 7 years. I wrote about Kashif Ali in 2017. You know, he was detained for 7 years in a maximum security jail before he was released by a court. In these detention reviews, and a lot of this is covered in the audit, which basically showed that the members, the board members who are kind of like a judge, you know, they were taking what the CBSA said as fact, even though in a lot of cases they weren't providing anything but the word of the officers. There are no rules of evidence in a detention review hearing. They're meant to be informal.
Right.
That's how the system was designed.
I don't think people have that image of them when you think about it.
No, and I wish I could show people the actual hearings. You know, when I first started showing up at them, and this is back in December of 2016, they were surprised that anyone was even there to watch them. They weren't, you know, they were not used to it. It wasn't like a court where anyone from the public can walk into a courtroom and see what's happening. You know, they had to make special accommodations just to allow me to watch, even though they are theoretically public and, you know, they announce at the start of every hearing, this is a public hearing.
Yeah.
They just, you know, were not accustomed to having any kind of public scrutiny.
Nobody shows up. What's changed in a year? Is it still bad?
So I should give some credit to the Liberal government in that, you know, they inherited a system from the Conservatives and they have, I think, made some significant changes. For instance, the use of jails has been reduced. So the Liberal government said they want to minimize the use of jails to only the most serious cases. And you know, when the conservatives were in power, it was roughly a third of all immigration detainees were sent to provincial jails. And now it's closer to 20%. The reporting that I've recently done shows that they're still routinely using maximum security jails for even nonviolent detainees. But the numbers definitely have gone down. One area where they've made a dramatic improvement is in the detention of children, which used to be more widespread. It's not the same, I should be clear, it's not the same problem as in the U.S. where families are being separated.
That's where everybody's mind was going.
Yes. So in Canada, there's no family separation. If there is a child who's in detention, they're kept with their mother. In some cases, parents are separated within the same facility, but the child will always be with one parent. Typically, the detention of minors is short duration. There have been some long cases, but I will say that's one area that the Liberals have made a dramatic difference in the number of children in detention. But it's still, I mean, the systemic issues are still there. The audit came out last year of the IRB, and you know, the changes I think will be implemented over the course of this year. I would like to see what the stats are, a year from now, to see if how much, if any, things have changed. But you know, one of the biggest things that critics of immigration detention in Canada point to is that there is no maximum length of time that someone can spend in immigration detention. It's indefinite. And that is an area that, some people point to as the biggest problem with Canada's system. In the European Union, they have an 18-month limit across the board, and some countries have a much shorter limit.
And if you can't deport them, you have to let them out.
Exactly. So in some countries, it's as short as 60 days or 90 days. Basically, that's as long as you can hold someone while trying to deport them. And if you can't deport them within that time, you have to release them with conditions in some cases, but you can't just hold someone indefinitely.
So as we're talking now, do you have any idea of how many people might be in a maximum security facility on immigration detention? And how often does that happen, like over the course of a year or so?
As I mentioned, I think that most time spent in immigration detention is relatively short. The average length is between 2 and 3 weeks. But Canada will detain somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 people in immigration detention in a year. Of those, on a given day, there's somewhere between 300 and 500 people per day in immigration detention. Of those, about 20% are sent to maximum security jails.
So around 100 at like any given time.
Yes. Yeah. And the thing that I would like to point out is that a lot of the long-term detentions are the ones that are in maximum security jail.
Right.
And I don't know the exact reason for that. I have some theories, but these are the most restrictive conditions that we have in Canada, and usually it takes a lot to put someone in a maximum security jail for any length of time, let alone on an indefinite basis going for months and years. But the scale of the problem in Canada is nowhere near what it is in the U.S. in terms of just the numbers are nowhere near the same.
Right.
But I think that, for someone who's being detained, 3 or 4 or 5 or in, Kashif's case, 6 or 7 years, I think that it's about more than just the numbers as a whole.
Brendan Kennedy, investigative reporter at the Toronto Star. That was The Big Story. For more from us, thebigstorypodcast.ca has everything you need. It has a contact us form because we want to hear from you. We also have a Twitter account at TheBigStoryFPN and at Frequency Pods if you just want to talk podcasts. And hit us up wherever you get podcasts. Hit subscribe, hit rate, hit review. We're on Apple, we're on Google, we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify. We are wherever you are. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.